Good afternoon. You're listening to KFSK Public Radio in Petersburg. It's Midday Magazine for Monday, the 31st day of August, 2015. I'm Joe Vicnicki with the local news. President Barack Obama begins his historic trip to Alaska today. The president's three-day trip is aimed at calling attention to climate change and how Obama says it's already damaging Alaska's stunning scenery. He'll become the first sitting president to set foot in the Alaskan Arctic. And in a show of solidarity with Alaska Natives, his administration is changing the name of North America's tallest peak, Mount McKinley, to Denali, to its traditional Athabascan name, Denali. And meanwhile, about that change, while it may no longer carry the name of President William McKinley, the White House says it's going to work with officials in Ohio to find another way to honor the nation's 25th president. Officials in Ohio, which was McKinley's home state, are voicing outrage over the announcement. And that's the name, the Denali name has been the name that Alaskans have used informally for centuries. President Barack Obama arrives later today in Alaska for a three-day visit. Petersburg and other parts of Southeast set some daily rainfall records last week. Petersburg recorded over 3.5 inches of rain on Saturday, the 29th, highest total for that date in National Weather Service records that date back to the 1940s. The day before, Petersburg had 2.61 inches, also a record setting August 28th. That mark broke the old record that dated back to 1947. It doesn't look like August, however, will set a monthly record. The total through the 30th was 13.18 inches. Petersburg's rainiest August on record was just 4 years ago. In 2011, the town saw over 17.5 inches of rain. Other southeast towns also set daily records on the 28th, including Point Baker and Kaufman Cove. Juneau broke a record that dated back to 1913. The first licenses issued in the state of Alaska for marijuana will likely be for growing and testing pot, not selling. That was the message this month from Cynthia Franklin, director of the newly formed Marijuana Control Board. She addressed the Alaska Municipal League in Ketchikan. Layla Carey has more on that story from Ketchikan.
One thing Cynthia Franklin has learned about people who like marijuana, they really like it.
Boy, there's a lot of passion around this substance. I mean, people really, a lot of people really, 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 really love it. Love it a lot. And they are so passionate about it. And I mean, I keep telling my staff, I thought the marijuana people were supposed to be chill. I mean, why isn't anybody relaxed, you know, when they talk to us? So.
Like everyone else in Alaska, though, those passionate fans are going to have to wait a while for retail marijuana stores to open. While Alaskans can now legally possess and grow cannabis for personal use, the state has until November 24th to finish writing regulations for commercial marijuana operations. That includes cultivation, testing facilities, and eventually pot shops. Franklin says she's hyper aware of the looming November deadline, and she makes sure the board is aware too.
I preach the timeline. I am like a timeline minister. We are absolutely going to give our best effort to getting these regulations out in the time frame set forth in the statute so that we don't throw you, the local government officials, under the bus, so to speak, under the marijuana bus.
She's referring to the penalty if the state misses that deadline. According to the ballot initiative approved by voters last year, if the state fails to draft regulations in that time frame, the task of issuing permits for commercial marijuana falls on local governments. Franklin says that's a great incentive for the state to not miss its deadline. But even if regulations are ready by November 24th, permits won't be issued until spring, and the first ones won't be for pot stores.
One thing that we did learn from Washington is don't issue all the licenses at once. Marijuana is a plant. You have to grow it. If you issue retail store licenses the same day that you issue marijuana cultivation licenses, you are putting quite a bit of pressure on your retail stores to find some marijuana to stock their shelves with, and it will not be legally grown.
Franklin says the first licenses issued most likely will be for grow operations and for testing that legally grown commercial cannabis. Speaking of testing, one AML attendee asked whether testing requirements will apply in places like Ketchikan that are off the road system and only accessible by boat or plane. Both of those modes of travel are regulated by the federal government and therefore are not legal for the transport of marijuana. Franklin says yes, testing still will be required, but the board is aware of what she calls the Alaska problem. She says the regulations have been written with rural communities in mind.
We truly believe that we will get adequate testing into the off-road communities that want to have marijuana establishment licenses. We believe that that operation and perhaps other operations will see a business opportunity in putting a gas chromography machine onto a boat and taking it into those communities to test their marijuana.
Another audience member asked Franklin about the veracity of the horror stories out of Colorado that were heard leading up to Alaska's vote legalizing marijuana. Some of those stories involve children ingesting concentrated edible pot and needing hospitalization. Franklin says she met with a chief physician at a children's hospital in Denver, Colorado, during a conference. That doctor told her that, yes, there was a jump in marijuana poisonings from 0 to 14.
They said more children come to the emergency room from poisoning by Tide Pods. Do you know what Tide Pods are?
Yeah.
They're detergent made attractive and candy-like, and apparently children love to eat them. And so they have more admissions to the emergency room in Denver for poisoning by child Tide Pods than they do by marijuana.
Franklin adds that most of the horror stories are from the first year after Colorado legalized marijuana. The problem was that legal medical marijuana dispensaries were the first places to offer legal recreational marijuana. And medical marijuana targets people who are accustomed to eating high doses of THC. That's the chemical in cannabis that creates the high.
What they found is when they turn the recreational market loose with those products, havoc ensued. And so they had to go back and rewrite their edible rules.
Colorado now sets its single serving size at 10 milligrams of THC, but recommends that first-time users cut that in half. So Franklin says the Alaska rules will set the serving size at 5 milligrams to encourage people dabbling with pot for the first time to start small and build from there. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
A Catholic priest who ministers here in Petersburg and is in Wrangell as well spent a month of his summer at a Jesuit retreat center in Los Altos, California. That retreat involved not speaking to anyone except a spiritual director for 1 month. Father Thomas Weiss has been a priest for 13 years after serving in the U.S. Coast Guard. He's the pastor at St. Catherine's Church in Petersburg and St. Rose in Wrangell. He says the month-long vow of silence was not as difficult as giving up his electronic devices during that time, and I spoke with him recently about the experience. Tell me about your vow of silence. It was a month-long undertaking?
Exactly, yeah. I did the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius. The previous summer, I did an 8-day retreat there while the 30-day retreat was going on for the rest of the group, and then I came back this year at the recommendation of my spiritual director and my bishop to make the 30-day retreat. The spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius were developed, obviously, by St. Ignatius while he was a layperson, just after he had injured his own knee in the Battle of Pamplona and had a rather long and difficult recovery. He was stuck in his family castle in Loyola with nothing to do. He really wanted to read, like, Harry Potter or Stephen King books, and all they had was the Gospels and the life of Christ and the lives of the saints. And he would imagine himself doing these. He was a knight, you know, with armor and the whole thing. He would imagine himself being a knight and winning his lady's hand, or he would read these books about the saints and the life of Christ. And he felt that there was some, the after effect or the afterglow. The knight one kind of left him empty, and the thinking about being a saint and thinking about Christ left him, like, filled with joy. And it took him a while, like 11 months, to realize that God was speaking to him through his emotions. And so you'll see Ignatian spirituality takes everything in your life and considers it material for an experience of God, which is really different than some of the other spiritualities that I've trained in, you know, where you have to be specifically reading the scriptures or, you know, looking at an icon. But this is, you know, I'm having a bad day. I wonder what God's saying about that.
Okay, so the vow of silence was just a part of this overall exercise then.
Exactly, yeah. Silence was to serve the retreat, if that makes sense. So maybe I can give you the daily routine looked like usually up by about 5 in the morning, and I'd pray for 2 hours before breakfast. Breakfast is in silence. So, and that's pretty easy to do. The tables were small, so you really didn't have to ask for the salt or pepper or anything. The hardest thing was not chatting up your neighbor, because you're like, oh, here's a new person, I'd like to talk to him. And most of my parishioners said he'll never make it.
But you did, I take it.
I did, yeah. And so breakfast was in silence, and then I'd pray for another hour after breakfast. And then at about 9 o'clock or 9:30, I would meet my spiritual director. And so you kind of have a guide through this whole process, and it's really wonderful. Mine was Father Jim Flynn. He'd been ordained, he'd been a Jesuit for 74 years, you know, just forever, which is super exciting.
What was it like for you to not be speaking for that length of time as someone who is so well-spoken and who uses their voice so frequently in their daily life? And what you do.
Yeah, for the first week and a half, it was kind of crazy. I was always, like, wanting to say something and not being able to, or just to smile or interact with someone or help somebody with something. But the real struggle was mostly with my electronics, you know, because I don't talk to myself when I'm at home by myself, and I live by myself, so there's a lot of silence time. But there was no podcasts, there was no streaming, you know, radio, and there was no looking stuff up. I didn't realize how interested I am in... you know, oh, I'll just look that up, and you get an answer because the world's encyclopedia is in your phone. And I couldn't do that. And there were some words that I could have really used some help understanding. And my spiritual director then, you know, helped me out. But I think both not being able to chat up people, because I do like talking, and not being able to look at my electronics, because they take them away. They're literally like, here, put them in an envelope, and you get them back at the end of the retreat.
And Wise says people can find out more about his month-long retreat and the issues behind it at IgnatianSpirituality.com. A new public sculpture is nearly completed for downtown Petersburg. Artist Eric Larson is putting the finishing touches on a bronze, aluminum, and concrete piece that will be installed at the Bushman Park next to the municipal building on Main Street. Here's more in this report. The sculpture is called Everything Starts with a Dream, and it's the third public work in Petersburg done by artist Eric Larson.
The fishing boy is bronze cast, the fish element is welded aluminum, and then the rock and the pedestal are concrete.
This is Larson's first foray into metal sculpture, and bronze in particular. He also produced Bruno the Bear, that's on Main Street by Viking Travel, along with the head and tail of the Viking ship Valhalla. Larson says he's been interested in casting Bruno in bronze as well to make the bear and his frequently stolen fish a little bit more durable.
So I'm looking, we're in Montana, we're from Montana, and I know a sculptor down there, Eric Thorson in Big Fork, and I've always been impressed with his bears. So I went and talked to him, and he said there's a foundry in Kalispell, Montana that does some of his casting. So I went and talked to him, and just... one of the co-founders of the foundry lived in Petersburg as a little boy, and it's got a history here. So I thought that's too much, you know, coincidence so that was the foundry. That was it.
That foundry ended up casting this sculpture in bronze after Larson shipped a full-size clay version of the work down to Montana. Larson first proposed this piece back in 2010 to commemorate the city of Petersburg's centennial. And it's been on-again, off-again work since then, mainly to secure enough funding to pay for the foundry to cast the sculpture. Arts Council members Cindy Lagadakis and Michelle Funt championed the project and helped raise the money and secure grants for the work. Now the sculpture is nearly complete. It sits in Larson's garage and shows a boy sitting on a rock holding a fishing rod surrounded by a swirl of fish. The work will have a shower of water raining down as a backdrop, and that's what Larson's working on.
Yeah, I'm right now trying to tweak the water to do what I hope it will in the end. So yeah, here's what we got so far.
A pan at the base of the work will be covered in river rock, and a pump will keep the water raining down from behind the boy, but Larson is working to get that water feature just right. It will also have lights once it's finished. Larson says local youth Gunnar Payne was the model for the fishing boy. The work will eventually be installed in a small new extension of the Bushman Park. There is already the start of a foundation built there on the corner of the municipal building parking lot. That's where Arts Council President Mark Kubo surveys the progress.
The Arts Council has been doing a lot of performance-type events, but you know, our mission is also to do visual arts, and this sculpture certainly fits that bill. And you know, it's in a nice place where people coming from the ferry terminal or from the cruise dock can see.
Other public sculptures in Petersburg are at the Boyer Wecon Fisherman's Memorial and the Fisk sculpture at the museum. Kubo thinks Larson's work will be a good portrayal of the community.
Well, public art in general, I think, encodes kind of a community's history, its culture, its values. And I think this sculpture will reflect that well. It's a young boy who is just dreaming about what he can be, and I think it represents what this community can be. You know, what can we dream? What can this community be if we just dream?
The bulk of the funding for the project came from Petersburg's transient room tax revenue, or bed tax. The budget for the project is $28,000 for the sculpture along with construction of the foundation. A date for the installation has not yet been set. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Wicknicki.